Hi, hello everyone, and welcome to the inauguration of the Walt Weekly Podcast Monday Night Edition. My name is Walter Latham Sr., aka Walter Stokes, or Booby Stokes. I'm your host, and I am joined by your co-host, Michelle Sweeney McCombs. Wow, what a special evening we have in store for you and us. We compliment this milestone, which we consider our Monday Night Edition. This is a new rollout. We normally hear every Friday at 6 p.m., but we added a Monday night edition, and our guest was gracious enough to be on the show as we roll this new show out. All right. She's a very, very special guest whom Michelle will introduce in detail a little later with her, about her background. And I can say that she is a businesswoman, entrepreneur, educator. She's extraordinary. So let's get it on. Michelle?
Hey, Walter. Thank you, everyone, for joining our Monday night series of the Walt Weekly Live. Thank you to our live audience for joining the podcast. The Walt Weekly is brought to you by Michelle Sweeney Hair and Skincare. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. Today's panel member, our weekly panel, returning panel, is Christopher Sweeney out of New Jersey, retired sanitation worker and CEO of Johnny Roo Smokehouse. Our next panel member is Honorable Gene Edwards, male district leader out of the 79th District from the Bronx, New York. We appreciate them joining us as always. Guys, thank you. Today's we have a special guest, Dina S. Ramsey, is a native of Martin County, North Carolina, and currently resides in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Dina is a graduate of Norfolk State University and holds a bachelor's degree of science in mass communications. Founder and CEO of Hodges in Halifax County. Did I say that correct? Correct me if I'm wrong, Dina. Awesome. Thank you. Which employs 14 people with various degrees in early childhood education or related field. Dina is also the founder and CEO of Hope First LLC, a mental health and substance abuse agency licensed by the Virginia Division of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services. Hope First LLC serves citizens throughout the state of Virginia, which employs 37 people with a minimum bachelor degree in the human service field. Dina currently serves on the board of directors for the Halifax Warren Smart Start, as well as the board of Halifax Warren, North Carolina Pre-K. She currently serves as president of the Community Women in Action organization who serves in Halifax, Warren, Northampton, Nash, Pitt, Martin, and Bertie counties. Outside of work, Dina enjoys spending time with her family and serving her community. She's an active member of Roanoke Chapel Missionary Baptist Church in Jackson, North Carolina, Northampton County. She wears a lot of hats, folks. Welcome, Dina. Welcome to the show. I don't think there's anything else left to say after I made that big introduction, but welcome. I'm sure you can add more to it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And thank you to our live audience and their family members and everybody out in North Carolina.
Okay. All right. Dina, how are you today?
I'm doing. I'm awesome, actually, and very excited about being here today.
Yes. We're very excited to have you. I know y'all guys did a lot of legwork for us trying to get this show, in people's face. And you did a tremendous job. I want to thank you and everybody that assisted you, and especially my niece, Bridget Stokes. So I'm going to give a shout out to Bridget Stokes.
Yay. Shout out to Bridget.
Yes. All right. So let's get down to some information. I mean, I left Williamson when I was like 16. I think you were probably in the 6th, 7th, 8th grade.
Yeah, right? That might have been still in diapers.
yeah, I know. So, I couldn't wait to leave. Now, you went to, after you graduated high school, and you graduated from the integrated school, right?
Yes, I did. I was in the first grade. I was one of the first groups to integrate school in Martin County. My class was one of the first. And of course, some of my siblings were a part of the high school group that was part of the integration.
Good, but how did that go? How did that go? Because I know we laid some groundwork for y'all guys.
Yeah, you all laid a lot of groundwork. I think it was a little harder for my older siblings that were going to the high school than maybe some of us in the elementary school, because we actually had the opportunity to stay at our school, which was E.J. Hayes School, which was grounded in an African-American community. For my older siblings, of course, they had to go to the school where the white students, basically their school. So I think it was a little harder for them, but we made it. And we had a lot of commitment from a lot of our community leaders, a lot of our Black teachers that were just determined that they were going to help us to get through it. And so we made it.
All right. All right. So now I do have, you went on to Norfolk State, right?
Yes, I did.
And what did you major in when you were at Norfolk?
I majored in mass communications, and it's interesting because what I do has nothing to do with mass communications. So that's why I say a lot of times that it is so important that our young people truly put some thought into what it is they want to do. They put some thought into their passion, and that we as adults that are around them in the school systems, in their communities, that we take the time to help them to find themselves and help them identify what their strengths are and what they're really good at. My experience at Norfolk State was good. Getting that background in mass communications was never bad. But here I am today. What I do is it has nothing to do with mass communications. But it was definitely a plus to have that, you know, to have that background.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. You can't go wrong with that. I'm sure you may be leveraging some of that, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. My communication skills started from way back. I have to be honest with you. I am a true example of it takes a village to raise a child.
Amen.
I grew up in a home with a single parent. With six siblings, and my mom raised three grandchildren. A small community, but everybody took ownership for the community. I watched my mom work two and three jobs endlessly to make sure that we had food, to make sure our clothes were clean, to make sure that we were never hungry, we never had lights out. But it was the community that came in to help her to make sure that we were healthy. It was my church community who at an early stage put me up in front of the microphone to make me read the announcements, to teach me how to read scripture, to give me that confidence to stand up in front of a congregation, which later has traveled with me throughout my journey in life. And so once again, we have to take ownership for our community. We have to take ownership for the children that are in our community and to make sure that they get what they need, whether their parents are good parents or whether their parents are not able to be the best parents. As a community, we are all responsible for them, whether we want to be or not.
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, we talk about that all the time. Michelle and the panel, Jean and Chris, that, you know, it takes a community to raise a child. And
yes.
You just affirmed that. And you said you had six Your mother raised six kids.
Yes.
Well, it was actually seven because I was there all the time. So.
Well, you were the seventh one.
Okay. I was the seventh one. Yes, yes. I was
slept
the
in the house with us, ate in the house with us. And I know this show is not about you, but I will say it is about you. You were from that same community. And you made a decision that once you left to go to college, you wanted something bigger and you wanted something better. So you moved away to New York. I took a different path and I made a decision to stay back. Not necessarily in Williamston, but from where we are, all the communities are the same.
That's right.
And so I'm very passionate about my journey. But first, before I go any further, I have to acknowledge God first, because it's only because of his grace and his mercy and the prayers that so many people have prayed to him for.
Somebody had a call coming in. So thank you, audience, for joining us. We see a lot of North Carolina love out there. We appreciate you all joining in, and our New York family and all our regular listeners. Thank you. Please follow The Walt Weekly. We can be found on IG and Facebook at The Walt Weekly. Thank you all for listening in. Dina will be back shortly. She has a tremendous resume there in her hometown. And we appreciate all her family from North Carolina, her church family, her school family. We appreciate you all joining in from Halifax, Warren, Northampton, Nash, Pitt. Please shout out where you're from, everyone in the audience. We appreciate and love to hear where everyone is from, listening in from. This live show is broadcast out of New York City live. Please join us this Friday at 6 p.m. We'll have another live show celebrating Black History Month. You can also check out our website, www.thewaltweekly.com, for past shows that we've had wonderful guests ranging from politics, entertainers, to artists. Our panel members are also in the house. Honorable Gene Edwards, he's a local Bronx, local 79th district out of the Bronx. We appreciate you all. Dina, if you could hear us, please hang up, disconnect, and come back in. In the meantime, The Walt Weekly is sponsored by Michelle Sweeney Hair Care. Our intro and outro music is provided by Uncle Nephew. You can follow him on IG and Facebook, Uncle Nephew. We also have Big Sween, owner of Johnny Roof's Catering. You can follow him on IG, Johnny Roof's Steakhouse. Thank you all. Give Ms. Ramsey a moment to call back in. We know you all are patiently waiting to hear her again. We thank you. Hey, Williamstown, North Carolina.
Williamston?
Wilmington. Yes. That's Maryland in the house. Maryland in the house. Hey.
Okay. Williamston. Williamston.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah,
hey,
I did come back in, am I?
Yes, you're
back.
Yeah. Okay, sorry about that.
Good job,
I did
Ms.
have a call. And fine. Shame on whoever that was calling me, because they should be on this podcast.
Hit the send button I had that a little interruption too. LOL. Hey, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Let's get back to the talk.
Excellent. Yeah, as you were saying, Dana.
Well, I don't remember.
But
what I am saying is that here's the thing, is that I believe, I'm a true believer, that regardless of wherever your background is, wherever you come from, big or small, that you can be anything that you want to be, but you got to work hard. And I will say this, no disrespect to men, but the bar is even higher for women. We encounter
most definitely
more. The disadvantages are definitely more. The discrimination is more in many ways. But what I say is this is, you're going to get knocked down. You're going to get beat up. You're going to get stepped on. All of that. But you have to dust off and get back up and go again. Nothing is given to you. It's all about the work, your work ethics. I've stayed up sometimes around the clock, 24 hours. I've had to endure many things. But hard work, I can truly say, it paid off. And I go back to my childhood because my passion is very, very, very deep with it. This is the thing that I made up in my mind. When I was a little girl coming up and I watched my mom work so hard for so little in return, I watched her go and work in the cafeteria at the school, leave there and go work at the cafe. We'd get home in time to make sure that we were ready. We had eaten, the house was warm, and held my older siblings accountable for myself and my younger siblings. And when I watch her work, I remember one morning her getting up very, very early. It was so cold. And I looked at her and tears started rolling down my eyes. And I said, this can't be right. It cannot be right. And so I made up my mind that day that I was going to work hard, but I was going to have a lot. And I was going to share my knowledge, my way of life, finances with others that I felt like if they were given the same opportunity and they put in the work ethics, that they would be okay too. I've done that in my profession. When I first, I've been into the childcare business, I will be celebrating 20 years in August.
All right.
And over the years, I've had people come to me wanting to open up daycare centers. They just didn't know how to get started. They didn't know what to do. They had knocked on other doors and were turned away. And so I would set them down, show them the steps, give them materials, and even go so far as to give them my policies and my procedures as a guide to open their own. Why? When a lot of people say, well, you just putting a nail in your own coffin. No, I wasn't. Because what I had, it belonged to me. So it's really okay if you go across the street and open up a center. You're still not going to be me. You're going to be you and you're going to do your thing. And so I've done that so many times over the years because we're supposed to reach back and help each other. We're supposed to do that. In my business now that I operate, I have probably 40% of my staff are young family members, nieces, cousins, siblings, because I just believe in my mind that you're supposed to show other people the way. You're supposed to guide them. You're supposed to help them. Now, I ain't for no foolishness. And I think that all of them will tell you the same thing, that she will help you. She will guide you. But you got to do what's right and you got to put in the work. And so I'm just grateful for my business. As I said, my childcare facility will be celebrating 20 years in August. We are a 5-star facility. We are one of only 2 private-owned facilities in our county that have been licensed by North Carolina Division of Child Development to be an NC pre-K site. We are one of only 2 facilities in the county that a private owner have Head Start, that's licensed for Head Start. So I'm grateful. But that didn't come to me. It didn't just come. Nobody gave it to me. When you are African-American business or childcare facility, and I got a relative that's on the line and she knows it, to be able to become a 5-star center, they don't give that to you. You have to work for it. Long hours to be licensed for NC Pre-K or Head Start. Those are things that private owned facilities just don't have. They're state owned. And to be one of the few, I am grateful. But that's a true example of the prices that you have to pay in order to be different. In my mental health agency, we're blessed to be licensed in Norfolk, Virginia, Emporia, Virginia, and Lawrenceville, Virginia. I have staff that I wouldn't replace for anything. I started out, we started out in 2008. So this would be 14 years for us in November. 75% of my staff have been with me since the day the business opened. Because they're invested in the company. I show them that it's not all about me. It's about them as well. It's about the growth for all of us. I care about them, but I don't just say I care about them. I show them that I care about them. I show them that they are part of, I may be the owner on paper, but I also let them know that I could do none of this without them. And I think that that is what success is all about. It's a team effort. It's about building a staff of young people and old as well, but just ensuring and making them understand that none of this could I do without them. You know, so that's my spiel. And I stand on it. It's the same thing at my childcare facility. Before COVID, I had people that were with me from the day the doors opened, and it's been 20 years. So I do believe that it is so important that business owners, the owners, truly know how to build a team and to show appreciation for their team, because that brings about success.
Now, Dina, going back to when you first started out as a Black woman, as you said, as an African American, and on top of that, you were a woman. You know, what type of problems did you run into?
Well, when you're dealing with the state and state mandates, the bar is always higher for us. You know, I had the opportunity to visit and to sit down and talk with non-African-American owned businesses before I went into business. And I would hear them say things like, well, you know, it's okay if you don't have this exactly right, or if you don't have that exactly right. They're just going to just probably talk to you and encourage you to do better or to get it corrected. Mike would just say, well, you know, you're going to have the same, because I know of a situation, you're going to have the same licensed specialist that we got. And they're really easy to work with, and they'll work with you. But when it came to us and they walked in the door and saw that we were African Americans, the bar was completely different. It was not that it's okay to make this minor mistake. It was that it was just, you're just not doing this right. You're just out of compliance. Where some of my counterparts, other businesses that were around that were not African American, these are the things that they told me, they might just give you a little slap on the wrist. And for us, it was like the end of the world. And if we come back and we see anything like this again, we're going to shut you down. You won't be operating. You know, it was just period. We're going to shut you down. But I will say this, that made us better. So as bad as it is, I was grateful for it, because it prepared us to, it taught us how to be prepared regardless as to who walked through the door. Right. So it's bad. It's bad, but it's supposed to make us better. And we're supposed to, you just, sometimes you got to jump through the hoops Now, I didn't just take it because I'm not one of those kind of black women. I put up a fuss and with a lot of legitimate reasons and with evidence. But they always have this little gray area that they can come back and use as a reason to. And so that's why we have to stay sharp. We have to read. We have to know the policies. We have to know the laws. Because when you can stand up, when you knowledge is power. And when you have that knowledge, it gives you the ability to not have to just take anything that people dish out to you, especially when it comes down to just pure out discrimination. So, like, knowledge is power.
Very, very true.
Yeah.
Especially, when you're serving the public and you're in an area like the South, but you never left the South. So a lot of things that you probably saw, you were accustomed to seeing, wherein, people that would let's say, leave New York and open up a business down there wouldn't understand or know how to maneuver. So you know how to maneuver.
Right.
It's like black and white, even though you mentioned a gray area. You know, yes. That gray area favors, your adversaries in a lot of times, mm-hmm. A lot of times, rather. But it is black and white, so you know.
Oh, it's black and white. There's no doubt about it. It's black and white.
Yeah. It's not like it'll be New York. Well, but anyway, I want to defer to the panel before we get too far ahead. Jean or Chris, y'all have any questions for Ms. Ramsey?
Yeah, I'll jump in there. Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to know, what made you pivot into the mental health space?
Well,
go ahead. I'll let you answer
that. What happens is when you live in small communities such as the ones that we live in this rural, it's very poor. When I was in Halifax County, which was where I started, it has the second and sometimes the third highest number of children in poverty. Much of that in the state of North Carolina. Much of that is contributed to substance abuse issues, mental health issues. And my journey started before I went into business on my own with the Department of Social Services, where I was the program manager for all child welfare programs. And I worked in foster care and adoptions, and I was an investigator for child abuse and neglect and treatment services. I saw so much in addition to poverty, but I saw so many of our people, our mothers that were losing their children, that had histories of mental illnesses that were never even diagnosed, okay? Because in the community we live in, those things are kind of swept up under the rug. You don't go to the doctor because you are depressed or because you may think that you have schizophrenia. Well, you just sort of live with it. And as a result of that, our children suffer for it. So when I left the agency, I went into childcare first. And I start running into that kind of thing, even in dealing with my parents that was in childcare. Of the children in childcare. And I made a decision because at that time I had one of my teachers that was there that left and had been prior, before working with an agency. And she was like, we really should do something about this. And you just have that passion, that love for it. It obviously shows in your work every day. And then I made a decision that I got to do more than what I'm doing. I got to do more. I've got to make more of an impact on the root of the problems, why we're seeing so much abuse and neglect, the root of why we're seeing so much, so many people in our communities that are just the alcoholism and those kinds of things. So I felt like if I get into mental health, I could make a larger impact because I would have more one-to-one opportunity to address or to be able to deal with those type of issues. Because at social services, my ability to do that was limited because that wasn't what we were actually supposed to do on a day-to-day basis. So I made a decision and to go into that field, and I was very, very blessed to have some of the greatest people come to work with me that had more background knowledge and had been in the field already, experienced, and that taught me a lot, even though I was the owner, but they taught me a lot. And so I feel like over the past 12 years, we definitely have not changed everybody. We haven't helped everybody, but I think we've made an impact. And we're going to continue to do that. And I'm so happy that you brought up that question because it's not just in our small community, but mental health is big. It's big all across the world. We're seeing our young people commit suicide. We're seeing people in our families that are going through depression and they're committing suicides, or their way of dealing with it is drugs and those kinds of things. So I think that there is definitely room for more people to get more involved in mental health because we just lost a young African American female from North Carolina that was Miss America.
Oh, yes.
You know, from suicide. And we just don't know. Depression is real. I'll just leave it with that. It's real. And that's why I tell everybody, talk to your family members, talk to your children, know where they are. When I say where they are, I say try to know where they are mentally and our loved ones, because people are going through a lot now. They are. And
especially during the pandemic.
Yeah, it's we've seen, since the pandemic, so many more cases in our agencies that are coming to us as a result of the after effect of it. But the strangest thing is, after the pandemic, it appears that the state is cutting budgets more and more and more for mental health, when the budget should be increased. But we're seeing a lot of cuts instead.
I was going to ask you about that, Dina.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it seems like mental health is being defunded instead of, you know,
yes,
seeing an increase.
Absolutely.
It definitely was during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Hasn't it picked up?
I want to also add that, you know, mental health and education, which I salute you for being in both arenas. Mm-hmm. We need more people like you. We appreciate you. I know you're held by certain constraints with how you have to maneuver, but is there special attention given to the African American point of view with your schools and with the mental health? Because our trauma and our pain is a little bit different. You know, our suffering
very different.
Is a lot more.
Very different.
You know what I mean? And it's not always understood from the other side.
Well, let me say this, that I think that, and it's probably all over the country, but in the small areas that we're living in here, I think that We are definitely feeling like these days there is a, I don't want to say a plot, but there are special efforts that are being put out there to, it's questionable whether they want African-American agencies to survive or not. things are being put in place that makes it very difficult for small rural African-American agencies to be able to survive in mental health. I mean, I'm just going to be frank. I think that in the area that we're in, that we're on a pretty level ground as far as funding and those kinds of things with childcare. But you got to remember, I live in a predominantly, my facility is in a predominantly African-American community, county actually. So the playing field almost got to be the same. But I will say, and if I had probably 500 African-American agencies that are in mental health, that are in not just my rural area, but in Richmond, Virginia, Fredericksburg, Norfolk, Newport News, Hampton, all across the state, they would join me in saying to you that there's special effort being put out there to defund us, which is a sad thing because in many of the communities we are living in, the point that we try to make to the state over and over again is that the communities we live in look like us. So we're going to be more successful at reaching some of our people because we look like them. So when I send a counselor out to a home and an African-American mother comes to the door that's like my mom, that was like my mom, maybe with 4, 5, 6 children, that's there by herself, with only her income or maybe public assistance, who is she more likely going to open up to and talk to? Somebody that looks like her or somebody that can't even begin to relate to her experiences in life? So what I say and what a lot of other folk like me say is, if you genuinely want to turn this mental health thing around, you got to keep us around. And I look at the services that we provide and the quality of services we provide, they are just as good as some of the agencies that don't look like us. And that's unfortunate right now because that's a battle that we're battling all across the state. And probably all across the country.
Well, I agree that most of the time, I mean, more often than not, when you send people there who understand the problem.
Yes.
And can relate to it, they can better serve the community. And also, you know, I think the motivation is, you know, to medicate our people all the time, you know, and put them on certain medication and get them all drugged up. But that's not fixing the problem. And, you know, you put them right back in that element where they came from. You know, you're really not, you're just putting a Band-Aid on a dam. It's just going to bust again. So,
when
we do have facilities where the people can relate to the folk that they're dealing with and just have these conversations, because again, our trauma and our pain is different. You know, we got
totally
a lot
different.
Of other things that we're dealing with in this country that we got to work through. And, you know, it's up to us to help each other to get through that. You know, I have a couple of family members myself who are in that system, and it's difficult. You know, we all got to band together and we pull together and we try to help them as best we can and try to recognize it ourselves. You know, once we get past the taboo of mental health, I think it'll be a lot easier for us to help each other. But, you know, our community, we have to wake up and acknowledge that there is, you know, a lot of mental health issues out there. And we got to.
That's the first thing. Yeah. That's the first thing.
Yeah. Thank you for answering my question.
I thank you for asking that question because I just think that we need to do more. We need to talk about mental health issues in the African-American community more. We need to talk about it. And I think that's something that we shy away from. And if we continue to do that, we're going to have more suicides. And I don't know if you all remember it or not, but I do. I remember when to hear that one of African-American killed themselves. That's something we used to didn't do.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't hear of it.
No. You know, but life. And that's where we are now.
And I also want to add, as African-Americans in the country that hasn't been kind to us, it is not out of the question for us to be dealing with mental illness and PTSD, right? Because we have suffered at the hand of people in this country that, you know, don't want us to be successful.
Right.
You know, so and been brutal to us, just literally. Mm-hmm. So it is not surprising that we do suffer, and you know, but we suffer in silence, and we got to stop doing that. You know.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you know, a lot of this stuff, high blood pressure, diabetes, things of that nature, is a result of years and years of oppression and having to deal with racism, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's going to blow up. The dam has to burst sooner or later. I think that that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah.
That is what we're seeing now. Gene.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, you have any comments for Ms. Ramsey?
Yes. Earlier in the broadcast, Ms. Ramsey, you stated that, you know, you said no disrespect to the brothers, but, you know, black women have it harder. And I wanted you to delve into that, because it is my belief that it's regional, whether, you know, a black woman can be successful or whether she has to fight tooth and nail for that same success. And I'm using New York City as an analogy from the Attorney General from New York State on down. The New York City Council is predominantly women. Our district attorney in the Bronx is a black woman. Our police commissioner is a black woman. The Bronx has its first borough president. Not only is the person black, but it's a black woman. So, you know, I don't see the struggle. I see the success of black women in New York City and New York State. That's why I say it's regional. So can you please just give me an idea of what you mean about how black women had to, especially yourself in particular, down there in North Carolina, which I know was a long time a red state. And we know what that entails. Mm-hmm. Please advise.
Well, you know, it's still a red state. absolutely. And it could be regional. The voice of, and we're gonna speak the voice of a man from where I'm from, it makes all the difference. From something as simple as I can go in somewhere. My husband is also in business as well. He's an entertainment promoter. And we can be doing the very same thing. And I will go into a place as an African-American woman and make certain requests. And I'll be told, okay, well, we've got a wait list and we can give you your documents in maybe 2 weeks. My husband can walk into the same place and make the request right after me. And he'll walk out of there with the documents right then. And I know that I am a very vocal person. I know, and I'm not a hostile black woman either. I don't go in with an attitude. I go in as a professional black woman. But I have to work extra hard to get what my husband gets. And I do. I do, because I know that the bar and the standards are higher for me. You know, I think that I feel and I understand what your question is about. Say if you're in corporate America, if you got a desk across the hall from a black woman, then maybe it might be a little easier for her. I don't have that experience here where we are, unfortunately. It's hard. It's hard for Black women in the South. You know, we just don't get the respect that Black men get. Something as simple as, which is not in line with the business profession, but something as simple as me just walking into somewhere. Let me use this as an example. And I'm going to go back to the root. Initially, what I was talking about was more in line with women do have more on their plates, of course. If a man from where I'm from has not completed his job tonight, but I stayed up all night long to get mine done. From where we live, if I walked in there and I didn't have my work done, then I'm considered a pure failure because I did not get it all done. But a man can walk in there and say, well, you know, I had other things going on. I've got this on my plate, this, this, and this, and this, and my internet went down, and I'll make sure that I get it to you tomorrow. If my internet went down, then I should have gone somewhere else and used an internet. And I'm just talking about my experiences, and like you said, it could be regional. But I worked around a lot of men in my husband's business, and I've seen things that they've been ever able to get away with that a Black woman never could have gotten away with. So I think that you're probably right. Depends on what region you're in. And then we have more on our plates anyway.
Okay.
We really do. Yeah. We gotta make sure, listen, we gotta wash clothes, we gotta clean the house, we gotta, you know, with the help, you know, of men, but they just can't do it like us. We gotta make sure after working 12 hours that the kids got what they need, that they are educated, that they are, you know, most women in the South, we have the majority of household responsibilities when it comes to domestic work. And so we've got to do all that stuff too. So I was talking about it from a business standpoint, just from my experience with what I've seen myself do in my business, and my husband can get away with a lot less. And that's not me being bitter or anything like that. It's just the way it is. So it ended up probably being more regional, I guess.
But don't you think that perpetuates as far as it would be detrimental to men if they don't have to have all their work done the same as you do? Don't you think that's a negative?
Well, I do. I do think it's a negative. But somehow they're able to get away with it, or somebody will make sure it gets done.
I want to pivot.
And so
Dana,
we kind of have to just make it happen. Okay.
Yeah. I want to go back to childcare. But before I do that, Michelle, do you have anything for Dana? Any questions?
No, you guys covered it. Chris tapped on the mental illness, which is what I wanted to ask about, but she tapped on it,
deep.
So I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Going back to childcare. Now, I was reading that's one of the most expensive things in a family budget.
It is.
Childcare. Right? It's up there with the rent or the mortgage almost in some cases. How are people coping? I mean, you being a service provider, what are y'all guys doing to try to mitigate or assist
people? It's tough. Because of the community that I live in, or my business is in, probably 80% of my parents are able to get subsidy, where the state and federal government pay a large portion of their child care because otherwise they couldn't afford child care. It is very expensive. And it has to be because in order for us to get good teachers, we've got to pay competitive rates. We got to pay them what they're worth. So it is necessary, unfortunately, that the rates are such that they are, but they're able to get subsidy. But even with subsidy, some of my parents still can't afford the share that they have. So I, as an owner, give a small grant for those parents who cannot afford it. Those funds come from when I do fundraisers or from other types of community resources. And so we kind of supplement those parents, parent fees who cannot afford that subsidy amount, that their share of it. So childcare, let's just say hypothetically, $1,500 a month for a baby, then the state may say we'll pay $1,000, but they got to pay $500. And many parents can't afford $500. So that's where my scholarship program kicks in. And we try to supplement them as much as possible, which is hard because donations and those kind of fundraising things have not been good during COVID. But we just manage to do as much as we can.
And what about COVID? Let's talk about COVID a little bit. You know, how has that impacted you in preparation and meeting protocols and things like that in North Carolina?
It has been really tough in childcare. Initially, it wasn't because mostly adults were the ones that were being diagnosed. And then the last few months, we've had just an outburst of children that are being diagnosed with COVID. So we just try to take all necessary precautions that we possibly can. We teach the children how to take care of themselves. We make sure no one comes into the building other than the children or the staff. And it's been tough because children, of course, you know, they don't want to wear a mask. And they want to touch, they want to play, they want to interact. So it's been extremely, extremely hard on our staff. It impacted the way we do business and mental health greatly, because during the peak of it, our counselors could not go out into the homes and meet with clients face to face. So it had to be done virtual, which we don't feel was as effective. But we had to do that in order to make sure that everybody was safe. So it has greatly impacted everybody. Everybody has been impacted by COVID.
Okay. Now, going back, you mentioned virtual.
Yes.
What did y'all, were y'all guys doing instruction virtually, or how did that work?
Well, our childcare facility never did close. We've stayed open during the entire time. We've had a couple of cases of COVID that we've closed in order to allow the children to quarantine. But during the peak of COVID last year, we never did close because we have a lot of our parents who have are essential workers. They work at the hospitals, the doctors, and, you know, they're first responders. So they still right. had to go to work. And so I had to ask my staff to sacrifice themselves to still be able to come in and provide care for the children. And so I take my hats off to them because that was a tough job.
Wow. I can imagine. You didn't have any breakouts wherein y'all guys were cited for being the start of a surge or something like that? Fortunately, you didn't have that, right?
We knock on wood, we were not. We were blessed and grateful as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, give me an idea, and I love that chair. You got to send me that chair when you tie that at the office chair that you have.
You got to send it to your uncle.
Yeah, you got to send it to me. Look real bumpy.
Got to send it to Uncle Booby. Yes.
Yeah, you got. Give me a idea of a tip. Give us an idea of a typical Dina Ramsey day.
Wow, you know, since COVID, I do most of my work from home now. And so when I hit the floor in the morning, The daycare is calling me, or the mental health agency, somebody's calling, and we've got a case of a client. And so I deal with issues that go on in the facility all day. I deal with issues that are going on with our clients with mental health, being a part of decision making as to how we should handle the cases, because, you know, every call that you get or every client that we visit, you know, could be a suicide. It could end up being anything. And so once we accept that case as our responsibility, then we are responsible. I don't do the counseling piece because we have counselors. We have licensed therapists on staff. And so a lot of the clinical piece, they do a lot of that. But there are a lot of administrative decisions to have to be made on a day-to-day basis. So I'm up early. I'm a little older now. I'll be 60 in November. So early in the evening, I try to get a little nap, you know, because most nights I stay up and work very late because I tend to get more work done at night because everybody's going home and the phones are not ringing. So, but the good thing about I'm finally having, you know, being working at home now is that I'm able to take breaks. And when I'm out at the facilities, I really get the breaks. And so, it's been a bittersweet because I miss seeing my staff. I miss talking to them face to face. I miss visiting the classrooms on a regular with the children. I trust the staff that we have in place, and they know that I'm just a phone call away.
Okay, so just to be clear, that you're remote most of the time.
I am remote. Yes.
Okay. Jane, Chris, you have any questions or comments for Dina?
I don't see any comments in our chat room. If anyone in the audience have a comment or want to wish.
She covered everything.
Yeah, she definitely did. If anyone has anything to say in our audience, we'll appreciate those comments and we will let Ms. Dina know.
All right. No, Dina, I do have a couple of questions. I know that you serve on the board of directors of the Halifax Warren Smart Start. Yes. As well as several other roles that you've taken on as president I have it written down here, but maybe you can just tell me the additional activities that you're doing on top of all the other stuff.
I'm fortunate enough to sit on the Halifax Warren Smart Start board, as well as the NC Pre-Capable. The Smart Start board, Smart Start was a program that was started by our governor some years ago that was designed to help us to reach children, more children before going to school at the age of 4 years old. And this particular board provides oversight, develop policies for childcare centers to ensure that our four-year-olds are getting what they need in order to truly prepare them for school. I sit on the board as a representative of all the childcare centers, so I speak for the centers, and I advocate for them to ensure that they get what they need in order to give the four-year-olds what they truly deserve. So with the NC Pre-K, which is also a program for designed for four-year-olds. It kind of has the same role, but it's specifically designed by North Carolina Public Schools. And so we are governed by them, and we make the policies for all NC Pre-K programs, which are for our four-year-olds. Because what we want to do is we don't want to see children leaving home or staying next door with the babysitter or a cousin or an auntie, and then get to school and not be ready. Because 9 times out of 10, it's going to be our children. And so that is one of the reasons why I agreed to serve on that board, because I wanted to have a voice, because in most cases, it would be our children that would get to school at 4 and be 2 years behind other folks' children. And so we work hard to make sure that those policies are in place and that that we provide the necessary oversight.
Okay. Are you seeing a severe decline in performance, academic performance from our kids as a result of the pandemic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a whole nother subject. Our children are behind. They're behind. And I concern myself with if they're ever going to catch up. Because what happened was a lot of the children were doing virtual. And so many parents were at work. Some were at home. Children didn't log on. Nobody held them accountable. Or sometimes children would log on and no teacher would be there to teach them. And so I can say to you that unless there is a child who had a parent that were really, really, really invested in making sure that their children got what they needed, in most cases, those children are at least a year behind in school. And some probably even more, because you got to remember, some were already behind. So, and it's scary because I don't know where that's going to take us. I don't know where it's going to take our children after this whole ordeal is over.
Yeah, that seems to be the common thought across the country, you know, as it applies to African-American kids and other minorities, is that they've fallen behind a couple of years at least. And,
yes.
And you know, what are the ramifications, you know, in the future?
Yeah, definitely.
And then,
definitely.
Too, we have to, yeah, and then, too, there were some parents that didn't know how to help them because they didn't get it. You know, they came out of school or dropped out of school, and they are not knowledgeable enough. They don't know how to help their children. So those children only forms of getting it was in school. So for the almost 2 years, year and a half that school has been out, those children haven't been getting anything.
Yeah, and you have to also deal with them in reference to their social skills have been impacted.
Absolutely.
Definitely,
absolutely.
Definitely.
You know,
I want to step in real quick and give some audience shout outs that are in here. I'm not sure the name, VYE. Thank you, Auntie Dina. You have done a wonderful job on this podcast. Van X, Dina is a giver to her family and community. She extends herself wherever she is needed. Proud of my sister, Kimberly. Awesome job, Auntie. I'm proud to be one of your employees. GTM, awesome podcast. Mama, you are truly an inspiration. Love you always. PTXJ, great auntie. Shana speaking facts. Florida family listening. Van X, she admired Oprah Winfrey as a youth and once wrote Oprah a letter to find out how can a black woman become a successful. She had a vision then, but Oprah never responded to her letter. But she kept the dream of success, and with success, she can help others. That's awesome, Van Candace. Okay, she got proud of you, Auntie. Tasha, you are a blessing to everyone. Montre, outstanding interview. We appreciate your family, Walter's family, also out of North Carolina. Thank you all for those comments.
We thank you, and I appreciate the support of my family. Being on tonight, they are always my support system. Always my, I just don't know of any time that I've called on them that they were not right there to support. And so I say this, that once again, it takes a village, and I mean a village. And I hope if none of us, anyone takes anything out of this tonight, is to remember that it takes a village. And when we look at our children, we're talking about our children being so far behind in school, it's going to be up to us to come up with ways and creative ways to help get our children caught up, whether it be to start small tutorial programs in our communities that they can come after school or Saturday tutorial services, whatever it may be. It's going to be up to us to help our children to get caught up, because it's not going to happen otherwise, because nobody's going to do it for us. We've got to do it. And so there's nothing too small that every one of us can't do to contribute to that particular, to that thing of trying to make sure that our children get caught up. That is my goal. That's my mission for the upcoming years.
That's great. And I like that. I like that, that phrase that you said. It's, we have to do it. We have to do it. We can't wait for anybody else to do it. We have to. Mm-mm. It's our responsibility.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay. All right, Dina, what's on the horizon for you? What are you, you know, what are you, any future plans?
Oh, wow. Well, as I was just saying, for sure, no doubt about it, I've been trying to, and see, here's the thing, is that I'm fortunate in many ways. I say blessed because God has given me a voice that I have been able to reach people and convince family and friends to jump in and just sort of make things happen. But not as big project as I'm going to ask them in the near future. I do want us to come up with some creative ways to work with our kids and help them get caught up. That's big on my agenda. It really is. I'm proud to say that I'm about to be a grandmother for the first time.
All right.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
I'll be a great uncle.
A great uncle. I've been blessed with one daughter, and she is due to deliver April the 2nd. So I'm very excited about that. Very, very excited to be able to share with my granddaughter or my grandson. Oh, please don't let my husband hear that. My grandson, my, you know, some of the things that I you know, am looking to do with my grandson. You know, I definitely want to be able to assist my daughter in any way to make sure that he gets on a good path to be a strong Black male. And I want to do more of this kind of stuff that I'm doing tonight. I want to be able to talk more to young people and those that are on, those that are in my family and around my with my coworkers. They know I have a strong passion for young people. And I want to see more of this. I want to see more of these type of platforms. I want to see more young people around me get involved in these platforms. Because I will say I've had a lot of family members that, young people that listen, and some of them don't listen. But when they don't listen, we still supposed to keep talking.
Yes.
When they don't listen and they decide that they're going to do everything that we tell them not to do, we're still supposed to keep talking and keep talking and keep talking. And after a while, the idea is that they will hear something. And so that's what it's all about for me at this point. You know, as I said before, I'll be a proud 60-year-old in November. So I'm not trying to take on I'm not trying to take on too many other big projects as far as opening new businesses or anything at this point, but who knows? But I want to share more of what I've been blessed with. And to be able to convince more people to get more involved with the community and to take our community back. Because I just don't think that no one can save our communities the way that we can.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dina. Thank you very much. Is there any contact information that you want us to include with our show notes? Because this will be rebroadcast on Thursday after 4 p.m. on all podcast platforms, Apple, Google Play. Michelle will go into more detail. But if you could share that with us, she can put it in the chat room now. Otherwise, you can email it to us and we'll embed it in the show notes for Thursday. Okay. All right. Now, before we move. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dina.
No, go ahead.
Now, I want to know whether
you can't have me up here. They'll tell y'all talking all night. You can't have me up here.
I love it. You sound just like my Aunt Helen, your mother. You sound just like her. You look just like her, too.
Yeah. Thank you. So,
Chris, Jane, y'all guys have any closing?
I just want to say, you're a fantastic guest.
Thank you.
You're passionate. I love it. Continued success. And it's great to see somebody in the education realm, but you rarely see somebody in both the education and the mental health realm. It must be a calling for you. And you're blessed. And continue doing great work.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate it.
Yeah, Jay?
Yeah, I just like to simply applaud you, Ms. Ramsey, for recognizing that education and mental health work in tandem. And, you know, you have mental health professionals on site, and you make sure that the students are taken care of, because it's kind of hard to study and learn if you're suffering from, you know, mental trauma, whether it be at home because your parents are, you know, fighting, or you're hungry, or as you stated, watching your mother get up early in the morning and it's cold and you cry because you wish you could help her. But right now you just are not at that point in life where you could be of an assistance. So recognizing that education and mental health work in tandem, I applaud you on your discovery and what you've done. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
All right. Anise, thank you. This has been a wonderful show. I'm so glad that you took the time. What you can do for me, for your uncle, is get Mr. Ramsey on. You have to come on. I'm very interested in hearing about Mr. Ramsey. I want him to come on. You can come on with him.
That's a tough job.
You're telling me.
I'll work on it, though. But I do want to say this in closing. I'm so appreciative to you all for this podcast. And for those don't know the history, Walter Latham, Uncle Booby is who he is to me. And I just am so appreciative for you reaching out to me, that you thought enough of me and my life, my journey, to have me on the show. I am so appreciative. And I just want to say this, because it was on my mind when I got on here, is that I tell people all the time, don't look at me and look at my success, because I'm going to say success, okay? I'm not rich, okay? But I will say that I have blessed, both my businesses are very blessed. But what I do want to say is this: is nothing happened overnight, though. Okay. Hard work, it starts early. I started babysitting when I was in the fifth grade for my school teacher and my relatives. From there, I started working in tobacco, because I was determined that my mama needed her money for her bills, and she didn't have any money to be giving me to buy other things. From there, I went to work on the Manpower program, which was designed for children from low-income families. And then from there to college, and I never stopped working. And I never, ever, ever stopped working. So nothing is going to come to you overnight. It's going to take some hard work and some long hours. And we as parents have got to learn that it's okay for our children to work at a young age. It's okay, because we've gotten to a place as a people that we feel like, well, I don't want my child to go through what I went through. Well, what's wrong with us having worked the way we did? It didn't kill us, right?
Nope.
So it's okay. It's okay. And I just wanted to put that spiel out there because a lot of people look at people like Uncle Booby, or they look at me, or some of you all too as well, because I'm looking at some of the roles that you have, and they think that this stuff came overnight. But it didn't. It came with a lot of sweat and tears and a lot of working at young ages as well. That's my spiel.
I want to piggyback what she said. It wasn't broke when it worked for us. So why are we not? Why are we trying to fix it? We need to stay with what worked for us and instill that in our kids. There's nothing wrong with hard work and a little sweat.
Mm-mm.
That's right.
Amen. That's right. Amen.
Amen.
Takes time to get to the top. Amen. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Michelle.
Okay. Thank you, Walter.
Speak later.
Awesome. Yes, thank you, Walter, and thank you to our guest, Dina. We appreciate you coming on the show. You're a wonderful person.
Thank you.
And many, many blessings to you for being the matriarch you are from North Carolina. We appreciate that. We thank our panel members, Gene Edwards and Christopher Sweeney, and of course, our live audience for joining us. Shout out to Walter's hometown, North Carolina audience for joining us.
Yes.
Williamstown.
So that's right.
Yes.
Yes. First episode of our Monday night series. We hope you all enjoyed this live broadcast out of New York City. This show will be rebroadcast this Thursday at 4 p.m. on all streaming platforms. Please join us for our next show, which is our regular show Friday Night Live at 6 p.m. You can follow us and get weekly updates on future shows and especially Walt's Corner, his weekly blog at thewaltweekly.com. You can find us at IG and Facebook, The Walt Weekly, Twitter, Walt Weekly, Podbean, The Walt Weekly. We can be found on iTunes, Spotify Radio, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and other streaming platforms. We thank you all for joining us. Have an awesome week. Be safe and see you all Friday night.
All right, Michelle.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I want to let everybody know before you hang up, guys, Muta Evans will be joining us on the 25th.
Oh,
this
wow.
Month,
that's family.
That's family. It. I just found out today she's my cousin.
Awesome. Yes, that's family.
Yeah,
that's
we're related.
That's right.
Yeah, that's family.
So
that's
right. February is Black History Month, so please join us every Friday night for February Black History Month, and also every Monday. So tonight was our first episode for the Monday
successful
night series.
Successful Monday. That's
very
right.
Very successful.
Monday
and
movers.
That's right. And next month, especially next month, is Women's History Month. Women's History Month. So that's huge for us also. So we look forward to hearing and seeing you all. Please do not just join us for Dina, but for Walter and Ubi as well. Thank you all. Good night.
Thank
everybody.
You. All right. Good night.
Good night.
All right.
Blessings.
Good night. Have a nice week.
Good night.